Good morning, everybody. It's great to be here. I've been here for a while, some, apart from Christmas, that is, but not standing up here. It's great to be back. And this morning we'll be looking at Matthew's Gospel, Matthew chapter 15, in actual fact, and then zooming back into Mark, which will be a connecting part of the story. At the Mission Church, the last couple of months, we've been looking at some of the questions that Jesus asked. And we were struck by the vast amount of questioning that he gave to the disciples and to onlookers and to the Pharisees and the religious bodies. And we used that as a launch pad into some of the questions he's asked. And we'll be looking today at some of those other questions he asked within this story. I came across an account of a supermarket the other day, and this chap wrote this. He said, "A new supermarket opened near my house. It has an automatic water mister to keep the produce fresh. Just before it goes on, you hear the sound of distant thunder and the smell of fresh rain. When you pass the milk cases, you hear cows mooing and you experience the scent of freshly mowed hay. In the meat department, there is an aroma of charcoal grilled steaks with onions. The sound of a breeze in the trees and water in a babbling brook welcomes you to the fish display. When you approach the egg case, you hear the hens cluck and cackle, and the air filled with pleasant aroma of bacon and eggs frying. The bread department features the tantalizing smell of fresh baked bread and chocolate chip cookies. I don't buy my toilet paper there anymore." You may have understood within the book of Colossians, which I believe you're looking through at the moment, the vast amount of images and tantalizing metaphors and the array of different things that Colossians brings about who Jesus is and about the nature of life under Roman occupation. And throughout the whole of the Bible, there are these many, many vast, colourful images within the Bible. I remember a few months ago we were looking at Isaiah as a church, and we were bowled over by the vast array of images that were there to try and grapple with, and things which took us headlong into what it means to follow Jesus. And this morning, as we look at a very familiar passage, the feeding of the 4,000. Again, we have images and descriptions of things by Jesus which the disciples don't really fully understand. And an encounter with the Pharisees later on in Mark's Gospels, which we'll look at, which again means that we have to unpack a little bit more than what's on the surface. And so here we go, Matthew chapter 15 and verse 29. "Jesus left there and went along to the Sea of Galilee. Then he went up to the hills and sat down. Great crowds came to him, bringing the lame, the blind, the crippled, the dumb, and many others, and laid them at his feet, and he healed them. The people were amazed when they saw the dumb speaking and the crippled made well, the lame walking and the blind seeing, and they praised the God of Israel. Jesus called his disciples to him and said, 'I have compassion for these people. They have already been with me for 3 days and have nothing to eat. I do not want to send them away hungry, or many may collapse on the way.'" Now, that's the context of the story. The story, basically, in a remote part of the Gentile region. It's a mixed audience. There'll be a mixture of Gentiles and Jews and others as well. He'd been eating with them, being with them for 3 days, so he had to eat with them. And that, in itself, is a bit difficult for a good Jew to eat with Gentiles. But there were probably roughly around about 10,000 people, if you include men, women, and children at this stage. And so Jesus is already, and has already, broken many ritual and social barriers by teaching and eating with the people and asking the disciples to do the same. And he presents the disciples with a dilemma. This dilemma is, we've been teaching, we've been hearing all sorts of things. We don't want to go away hungry. Where the nearest place to eat is miles away. What shall we do? Basically, he presents a scenario to the disciples, and he asks them to do something about it. What is he doing at that stage? First of all, I would say that Jesus is giving the disciples an invitation to share in his mission. That's what essentially what Jesus is doing. What many theologians call is missio Deo, God's mission. And Jesus is doing that. He's given the chance to resolve problems and to explore possibilities. By doing that, he's awakening the disciples to the responsibility they have, both in terms of their emotion and in terms of their work. Jesus says, I have compassion on them and I don't want to send them away. He's saying to them, look, these are the ground rules of which you are to conduct yourself, and you're going to get hold of this dilemma and answer this situation. I have compassion. I don't want to send them away. What are you going to do about it? And their response betrays their focus. Their response in verse 33, where can we find enough bread in this remote place to feed such a crowd? Jesus says, I've got compassion. I don't want to send them away. What's your answer? What are you going to say in terms of resolving this problem? The disciples say, it's insurmountable. We can't get round this problem. There are too many people, and it's in a remote place to send someone off to the next Tesco. So we've got to find an answer to the problem, which we don't have in our midst right now. Now, what do you think Jesus would want them to answer? Well, if you turn back a couple of pages, you'll go to Matthew 14, and you'll realize it's the story of the feeding of the 5,000. Now, we don't know exactly when this took place, but you've got an understanding that Jesus is probably wanting them to say something like, do what you did before. You know, we've been in this situation. It's a bit of deja vu. It's the idea of, well, I remember somehow in this my recent memory, Lord, that something like this happened a few weeks, months ago, and you sorted it out. Now, that was perhaps the inward frustration of Jesus, and we'll come on to that in a moment. Do what you did before. But instead, they bemoan the remoteness, the lack of bread that they have, and the size of the crowd. And it's frustrating, isn't it, in any sphere of life, when our resources seem inadequate to the task, when our experience or our skill or our energy or our money can't cope with the remoteness of the task, the size of the crowd, and the lack of resources that we have. What is our response? Our role and our response is not to knee-jerkingly react to inadequate resources, but to reflect, imagine, create, and distribute from what we have with the possibility of supernatural intervention. And that is the point, that actually we do all that. We reflect, imagine, distribute from what we have, create and address and explore the possibilities, but with the possibility that God may somehow intervene miraculously beyond our work, beyond our emotion, beyond our grappling, beyond our thinking. So every piece of work, with the hands and our minds and our hearts for the Christian, is collaboration with God in his mission. It is what we're doing. It isn't our mission. It is collaboration with God in his mission. Mission Deo. And the Christian life, as the disciples steadily are finding out, is a disciplined rhythm of being fed and feeding others. This is what they've done. They spent 3 days listening to Jesus teach them on all sorts of manner of things, the kingdom and what it means to have Jesus in their presence. And they have a focus on Jesus and themselves. Jesus tries to get them out of that focus, to look to the crowd, to see what they have and answer the problem they've got in their midst. And all they can see is the crowd, the remoteness, and the bread. And he's trying to teach them that actually the Christian life is not just about listening and feeding. It's about distribution of what they had and feeding others. Let's go on to the connecting action now in Mark's Gospel. Mark chapter 8 and verses 11 to 21 is basically the same account, but it has a slightly different emphasis, and we're going to really focus on now the response of the Pharisees. because we know the end of the story, don't we, for the feeding of the 4,000. If you don't know, basically Jesus sorts it all out and everybody goes away happy and fed. I'm sure you know the answer to all those things. Here we are, chapter 8, verse 11. The Pharisees came and began to question Jesus. To test him, they asked him for a sign from heaven. He sighed deeply and said, "Why does this generation ask for a miraculous sign? I tell you the truth, no sign will be given to it." Then he left them, got back into the boat, and crossed to the other side. What do the Pharisees want? They want a sign from heaven. They want to make Jesus' miracle of providing for that 10,000 people, as he did, they wanted him to confirm that somehow that was something that's said about Jesus. That was a sign to say that Jesus was the Messiah. To confirm Jesus' claims, they wanted not only a sign to confirm that Jesus was who he claimed to be, but they wanted a sign from heaven. A sign from heaven was basically a sign from God. It was an apocalyptic sign, a sign of triumph over their enemies. So they wanted confirmation of the certainty of who Jesus was, and they wanted a sign from heaven in order to demonstrate their deliverance over their enemies. Give us a sign of triumph and certainty. They wanted unequivocal, irrefutable proof to remove all doubt that Jesus was who he claimed to be. And what does Jesus say? Verse 12. He sighed deeply. "Why does this generation ask for a miraculous sign? I tell you the truth, no sign will be given to it." The Christian life is not based or built on irrefutable, watertight proof. If it did, it would remove all faith. Faith is trust that what we hope for is certain, not being certain that it is certain. Do you understand that? Faith is trust that what we hope for is certain, not being certain that it is certain. And an authentic part of the Christian life is an experience of temporary atheism. It is an experience where somehow, sometimes, we experience the uncertainty of faith, the gift of uncertainty, the trust that actually what we're going through, even though we don't understand it and God may not be there or feel as if he's there, somehow we trust through those circumstances, but we're not certain. And there's a vast difference between what they were asking and what Jesus was going to give them. Here, their whole basis was based on their whole idea of certainty and triumph. It was a wrong, narrow vision of the kingdom. And what did he goes on to say? Verse 14. The disciples had forgotten to bring bread except for one loaf they had with them in the boat. "Be careful," Jesus warned them. "Watch out for the yeast of the Pharisees and that of Herod." They discussed with one another and said, "Is it because we have no bread?" Now here again you get the dullness of the disciples, and that is comes out very clear here. But here Jesus is talking about yeast. Now, we all know what yeast is. We've seen already a demonstration of baking powder. And when we bake at home, I'll rephrase that, when Lorna bakes at home, because obviously you wouldn't want to eat anything that I've tried to bake at home, but we bake a little homemade bread, and yeast is used to enable that bread to rise. It's a wholesome ingredient. But in the day of Jesus and in the Old Testament, yeast or leaven was a potentially dangerous product. It was basically how bread was baked in those days in the first century was keeping back a little bit of the yeast or a dough from the previous week's bread and mixing it in with the next week's. And it had a potentially dangerous role if it wasn't mixed in together with the right amount of other juices and stored correctly. So it could infect, if it wasn't done correctly, the whole batch of bread from that week. And so the idea that Jesus is saying here, that the yeast of the teaching of the Pharisees could infect the disciples. That somehow what they were saying, their narrow vision of the kingdom, could infect the disciples' understanding of who Jesus was. Because it was based on triumph over their enemies, it was based on creating barriers against the Gentiles, and it was based on demanding certainty. And the disciples needed to know that their view of the kingdom was dangerous and potentially poisonous. That's why he goes on to say, be careful, watch out for the yeast of the Pharisees and that of Herod. Now, the disciples, I think, have got a problem with boats. I realise this when we're going through some of these series. Jesus was on a boat in verse 13, then he left them, got back into the boat and crossed to the other side. What is it about disciples and boats? You remember some of the stories. Jesus walked on water and suddenly they're afraid. Jesus calms the storm and they've got no faith. Now, in connection with a boat, as they've been discussing, is it because we have no bread? Jesus, verse 17, aware of their discussions, asks them, why are you still talking about having no bread? Do you still not see or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes but fail to see and ears but fail to hear? And don't you remember when I broke 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up? A whole array of questions he asked them to get them to trigger off their memory. Somehow, getting into a boat has disturbed their memory. Now, Lorna and I have got a problem with boats. The last time we went in a boat really together was in our on our honeymoon 17 years ago. We went out on a boat down in Cornwall. I was sick for 2 hours on a fishing trip. Lorna got a black eye from banging a face against the side of the boat. Well, that's the story I say anyway. And so we don't do boats. We don't do boats. When somebody says, it's just a short boat trip across the bay. No, sorry, we don't do boats. No. And you can imagine the disciples saying the same. Jesus says, we're going to get into a boat. No, no, Lord, we don't do boats. Something happens to us when we get into a boat. You know, remember the last time you came walking and we were afraid? Now somehow we're in a boat and we haven't got a clue what we're talking about because we're going on about bread. You can imagine. Here they have a unique opportunity as insiders. And this is what's going on here, that somehow Jesus has brought the disciples together over a number of months and years and bringing them into the privileged community and inside understanding of what he's trying to do in the wider world. But he's not giving them answers on a plate. Whilst they are insiders, they're not given access to everything right there, right now, or laid out neatly for them. He's giving them an experience of God breaking in, God's reign breaking into their midst, but he's not giving them answers. Despite, I think, Jesus' intense frustration, he gives them all these questions. But like a good teacher, he just keeps on asking questions. Do you still not see or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes but fail to see and ears but fail to hear? And don't you remember? Now, for those of you who are parents, you'll know that the process of teaching your children homework or helping them with the homework is one of the most painful experiences you could ever go in all your lives. And as Dylan has got to secondary school, we've been trying to teach him or be involved in any way as much as we can his maths. And like me and Lorna, he's not a great one for maths. And you have that intense frustration when you're going through, particularly things like maths, to get right to the end and give them the answer. Because the way that maths is taught these days is far different from when I did my O-levels back in 1980s sometime. Because, you know, it was just so different. And so you come to the maths. And this happened a few months ago. We were sitting there with these maths questions, and I just wanted to get out a calculator. Just write the answer down, okay? But I knew that Dylan had to get from A through to B through to C through to D to get the answer. Because if he didn't go through that process, then he wouldn't be able to work it out for himself to get to the answer if I wasn't there. And there was no point in just plonking the answer in front of him. Now, I know you are far more patient than I am in that realm. But actually, it's a similar thing that Jesus did. that actually he asked questions. He put the evidence of the kingdom before them. And he said, work it out. Read the clues. Here are the clues. Here are the footprints of the kingdom in your midst. Work it out. And the Christian life demands that process. The Christian life, the Christian faith, is seeking meaning in the complex. It is exploring hope in the despair. And it's learning to trust in the confusion, but it's not answers on a plate. That, it's certainly not. And the disciples' dullness, their dullness was essentially a failure to reflect and a failure to remember. And don't you remember, Jesus says. Now, you may know that remembrance was a key to Israelite faith. The whole of the Old Testament is virtually built on the idea, especially because it was an oral culture, that they remember, they remember, they remember what God has done in the past. And very often, the prophets go through remembrance to the nation. Remember how God took them out of Egypt, how saved them in the Exodus. And time again, if you look at the Psalms, you look at all the prophetic books, you go through many of the narrative and historical books, it is banging on this idea of remembrance. And here, Jesus, in good Jewish Israelite tradition, tells them to remember. If the disciples had remembered, if they had reflected, they had overcome their narrow field of vision, released them from their anxiety about their limited resources, and see that God had already done something miraculous in their midst already to overcome the difficulties they had with the remoteness of the task and the bread and the size of the crowd. But they continually were unable to recognize the meaning of the events which they were witnessing. Now, I'm no scientist, but I know that in science, when there is a communication of a signal between the signal that's going off and the recipient, there is a thing called noise. And noise basically is the undesired interference which can sometimes get between the signal going off and the recipient hearing it. And basically the signal carries the information or the data. And this is what was happening here, that somehow the signal that Jesus was giving, the messages that Jesus was giving to the disciples and to the Pharisees about the nature of himself and the nature of his kingdom were being not listened to or not heard because of the noise of various different circumstances. The noise initially for the disciples was the noise of the crowd, the size of the crowd, the remoteness of the task, the inability to see beyond the resources they had. And somehow the signal, the message that Jesus was trying to put through to them wasn't getting through to them. They weren't being receptive because they weren't remembering. And we are to hear. We are to listen for the signal through the noise of our circumstances. Not ignoring the noise, not trying to bypass the noise, but through the noise. To hear what God calls us to do, calls us to be as individual Christians and the church. Because there are plenty of noise in this world and in our churches which do prevent us from hearing what God is saying to us. And here, as part of our task, is to remember and to reflect what God has done already in order to understand what can God do right now. It was key to Israel's experience and it's key to ours. But if we go back a moment and we go back to verse 12 in chapter 8, we see these words, he sighed deeply. He groaned deeply is what some translations say. And it's something for the Pharisees and it's something for the disciples. What makes Jesus groan deeply? What makes Jesus groan deeply about our own lives and our church? Is it our narrow vision of how God works? Is it our irrelevant mission? Is it our small-minded worship? Is it our indifference to injustice? Is it our distractions? Is it not being able to see God at work, indifference? Is that failure or reluctance to trust? I don't know. But somehow, sometimes, I think God and Jesus both groan deeply at us because of our inability to listen, to trust, to reflect, and to remember. So one final thing. Jesus says in verse 19, "When I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up?" 12, they replied. "And when I broke the 7 loaves for the 4,000, how many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up?" They answered, 7. He said to them, "Do you still not understand?" Well, I don't blame them, actually, because I don't understand. What is Jesus going on? Do you get the idea that Jesus is putting down the clues? He's putting down the footprints, but he's not giving them the answer. He's telling them, work it out for yourselves. There's something about your faith which means you've got to do something. You've got to participate in working it out. I'm not going to give you certainty, and I'm not going to give you answers on a plate, but I'm going to give you a whole load of questions. He was wanting them to see something more profound than just a demonstration of power. Something more than just a nice story about Jesus coming up trumps again and saving the day. Now, some people think there is significance in the numbers, and they may have a point, that Jesus asked the question, how many, is intended to lead them to meaning beyond what they just see. Some people have said that the 7 particularly refers to the symbolic understanding of completeness and perfection, i.e. Jesus in their midst. It may also mean, as it was an associated number with Gentiles, that he was actually saying something about the nature of his mission, that actually, as the complete embodiment of the Messiah, he was going to go now to the Gentiles, that the kingdom was for the Gentiles. It may well have been that Jesus was pointing to. But whatever, they got the right number, but they got the wrong answer. They answered 12 and they answered 7, but they still didn't understand. Jesus wanted to move them beyond right figures, right facts, right doctrine, and move them towards meaning and perception. Now, you know, there is such thing as a credit crunch at the moment. And for the last 6 months, people are trying to unpack it, unpack all the facts, all the figures, all the money, all the dots, all the pounds, all the whatever. And somehow, somewhere, there is someone that knows exactly what it all means. Probably Robert Peston from the BBC is perhaps the only one that knows about it. But the fact is that we can count all the figures, and we can work out how much all the debts are, and we know how much people are getting in pensions, and we can know the facts and the figures and all the answers, but actually none of us really knows what it all means. And there is a difference. There's a difference to knowing all the facts, all the figures, all the things about the rightness of our Christian life, all the right doctrine, all the right things marked and dotted and teed and everything like that, but there's a difference between facts and figures and meaning and perception. But also, we know the facts and figures of our own circumstances. The uncertainty, the illness, the job difficulties, the finances, the family tensions, all the things that sometimes a current climate like this can produce. We can tick yes, because we know all those facts. They're plain and simple in our lives. But what we don't know very often is how to act within them, how to live credibly, faithfully, according to Jesus within them. And I think Jesus is saying this. Jesus is saying to the disciples, I am in your midst, I am the Messiah, I am expanding your field of vision, and I'm giving you the opportunity to work it out with the possibility that I will intervene, that I will be there with you intervening. That the meaning is harder than just ticking all the right answers. One final thing. We've got a couple of images up here. First of all, you may know that, or you may like jigsaws. I hate jigsaws. I've never, ever liked jigsaws. I find them boring and monotonous, and I haven't got the patience for them at all. And Lorna likes jigsaws, And I know the family have done jigsaws, and they're very, very frustrating things. But the frustrating thing about jigsaws, first of all, is actually if you get a jigsaw like that, which actually you've got no picture on it, it makes it slightly more difficult, doesn't it? Okay, you don't start a jigsaw. Even I know that you don't start doing a jigsaw with the picture on the flat so you can't see it. So you see something like that, and you know that actually the only thing you're going to able to put together is actually the slots by their size and their shapes, slipping them into the holes. So you don't put together a jigsaw like that. So what you need, the second part of that, is that you need to turn it over. But the problem you've got is actually the complexity of the picture. Very often, if you have some of these jigsaws which have like a big can of beans, and well, you've just got a whole load of beans. Have you seen those ones? Like 1,000 pieces just with a whole load of beans. I mean, why do people ever want to do that kind of thing? Are they mad? I mean, why are they just, you know, insane people that want to do that kind of thing? But with a picture like this, okay, you have a starting point. You have a chance to be able to connect bits of a piece and photos together to actually put things together. Now, that's the second stage. The third stage is this. It's not a very good picture because I've just sort of cut and pasted off the top of there. The fact is that actually if you've got the box in front of you with the actual picture complete as a whole, as a starting base, and you haven't picked it up as a bag from a jumble sale, well, you haven't got that box, then you are further down the line in understanding how to put the jigsaw together. You need all of these things put together like that. And what Jesus is saying to the disciples is this. You've got to be confident. What have you got to be confident about when you're putting a jigsaw together? That's a question to you, actually. Sorry? It's all there, yes. That is the starting. You've got to be confident that if it says 1,000 pieces, it's 1,000 pieces. If it says 100 pieces, there are 100 pieces there. Because if you don't have that confidence, if you don't have that ability to know that somehow the answer is a 500 or 1,000, then there's no point in starting it because you don't know which piece is missing. Jesus is saying to them here, he says, the numbers add up. I am the Messiah. I am in your midst. I am the one that is bringing God's reign into your midst. Now, understand what that means. Understand what that means for your life, for your mission, and for the inbreaking kingdom of God. But, as we know, that he kept on giving those questions. He kept on not giving them answers. Because part of their training, part of their discipleship, was working through the meaning of his presence in their midst. And that is our task. Our tasks as churches, to know and to understand what it means to have God's presence in our midst and by our side, to work it out, to work out meaning and perception beyond what we just see in front of us. Let's pray. Father, continue to challenge us and question us and change us and motivate us to live for your kingdom. Thank you that you have broken into our lives. You've broken into our churches and into our communities. Continue to do so, Lord, and help us to work it out, to pick up the clues, to see the footprints, and to see your work in our lives, in our communities, that we may continue to remember and reflect and to explore problems and possibilities when we are faced with them. In Jesus' name, amen.